My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. Our next guest described how he suffers from imposter syndrome, yet he has achieved so much in his life so far. He's a former Gurkha officer, helicopter pilot, and spent over a decade with special military units. We speak about his chaotic childhood with an alcoholic father, boarding school, pressure, conflict, and why he cherishes every minute he has with his daughter. Episode 43, Ash Alexander Cooper. This is Declassified.
Mate, can you tell me about the overdose in 1976?
It wasn't mine, I'll firstly say. that's my first childhood memory, actually, sadly. So I was born in 1973, and my first childhood memory is the day, actually, more in my mind, is it was the day our dog died. It was a really hot summer, 1976. You probably weren't even born. Were you born? No. It was a hot summer, and our Great Dane sadly died, and she kept on leaving the house and disappearing, and we kept on trying to go and find her. And she was, apparently this is fairly common with animals that know that they're sort of near the end, and she was going and hiding in other people's gardens and, you know, just finding somewhere quiet to lie down. Anyway, that happened to be the day that that my dad had taken an overdose. And so it was just, it was a busy day of vets and ambulances and all sorts of things. So, yeah. Mm.
But what way was the overdose? With drugs or alcohol?
With pills, I think. A mixture of alcohol and pills.
Yeah.
So my dad's a manic depressive alcoholic. So sort of childhood was punctuated by episodes of dealing or avoiding, you know, that.
Was there ever a good point? So you're three and your first memory is an overdose.
Most of my childhood memories sadly relate to incidents that are, you know, sort of shocking in hindsight or were at the time. So the times in my childhood that were more positively memorable are ones where I was generally away from home doing other things, you know, whether it was, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about in a bit, the choir stuff that I did, or just things that were away.
Mm. And that early childhood, because I'm just going to keep us there for a little bit. What was day-to-day life like, kind of dealing with someone who's an addict, essentially?
I was very, very young for those early periods. I mean, it got, I guess, harder as I got older, and, you know, my siblings as well, you know, equally found it hard and have been impacted similarly. But I think as you get older, you start to question why without necessarily understanding. And I think the biggest issue for me and the challenge was a failure to acknowledge that there was an issue, you know, on the part of my father. So, you know, every time he took an overdose, which happened quite a few times, and was admitted to hospital, he would always discharge himself before the psychs could actually do anything useful. And it would just sort of be ignored or rather brushed over that nothing had happened. So I just used to try and spend as much time away from home as possible, and luckily had the structure with a few things that I was doing to be able to do that and spend time with other families and, you know, friends who were seemingly more traditionally normal, let's say.
Well, how did you get to boarding school then? Because you was only eight when you started that.
Yeah, so I some reason was spotted as being able to sing. So I did some choir or singing tests and was lucky enough to get a place in a choir called Winchester Cathedral Choir. So a big cathedral down in Winchester. And because of the number of services and the sort of the schedule you had to live, you know, singing before, practicing before school, doing a full day school and then singing services in the cathedral in the evening or the afternoon. And at weekends you had to board. So it wasn't necessarily a choice to board at age 8, but if you wanted to be in the choir, that was a requisite.
Mm. So because I have no idea about this, how this works. So
you weren't in the choir?
Yeah, no, funnily enough. So someone spots you in your normal school with your parents and your family, and then you get selected to then go to
school. You apply. I think you apply then to do choral trials, I think they may be called. I can't remember the detail, but I remember doing various tests and was sort of, you know, identified as having some potential.
Yeah.
So age 8, I joined a school that was the choir school for Winchester Cathedral, and then did that for 5 years.
Right. So the school then provides the choir for Winchester Cathedral.
Correct. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm with you. So then schooling would be, what is it, Monday to Friday, or was it term?
No, it was the whole time. So, you know, you'd sing all the services on a Sunday, you know, 2 a.m, 1 p.m. So you didn't get to do sports on a Saturday afternoon like the rest of the school. So I got very much into rugby and things like that. But yeah, it was 7 days a week of doing choir stuff, as far as I remember. And then when everyone else left to go home at the end of term, you had to stay as the choir. So, you know, Christmas is a good example. If the term finished, say, on the 12th or 13th of December and everyone went home for 3 or 4 weeks, we had to stay till Christmas Day evening. Yeah. So there were 20 kids rattling around the school for 200 or whatever. But it was good fun. They put on extra, you know, activities for us, and we got an extra stocking. You know, Santa was very kind and gave us a stocking at school as well as when we got home.
Yeah.
You just accepted it. It was all I knew.
Did you want to be there though as well, because of the chaotic kind of whole?
Yeah, I wasn't quite as aware of how much of a refuge it was in those early days, but certainly I remember towards the end, you know, that was the structure that gave, and actually seeing the joy that you could bring to others as well when you were singing. You know, the choir was a pretty decent choir, and we were selected to do a number of things, including a thing for Andrew Lloyd Webber called the Requiem in the mid-80s, and we were flown to New York and sang the world premiere on live TV, 60 countries or something. You know, a fairly big deal for a kid running around Manhattan for, you know, having not really travelled before, singing with the Vienna Boys Choir in Vienna and in their very cool music hall. All these things were incredible experiences that kind of opened my eyes to the world, and therefore the joy you could bring when you were singing, and, you know, people were giving standing ovations because you know, it was a fun time. That was enjoyable.
Mm. And then going home in the brief periods you had to spend, you know, time, summer holidays or Easter holidays or whatever, was that enjoyable?
I honestly don't remember it, and I don't know whether it's a conscious blocking it out, but I don't really remember any of those times up to the end of that period at school.
In regards to what period at school?
So that sort of 8 to 13, I don't remember really any of the holidays. We didn't go on holiday. We had two holidays, I think, overseas. That was it. They were very short. There's nothing that really stands out in my mind as being memorably positive.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe that's what it was. Maybe it was a blocking out.
Maybe. Who knows?
What did your mum and dad do for a living? Was you well off?
My dad was a copywriter and very good at his job. But of course, with all these addictions or illnesses, that starts to impact your ability to do your job. And so because he was so unreliable with deadlines and stuff, I think, you know, we had been comfortably well off, I would say. But increasingly, clients walked away when he was not delivering. So, you know, it became difficult. And then, but he was the breadwinner. So, yeah, everyone relied on him to be delivering, but he wasn't.
Do you have fond memories of your mother?
Yeah.
In the early life?
Yeah, yeah.
Was she comforting?
I mean, she was trying to keep it. She was trying to keep everything together.
Yeah.
For us, and tried to protect us all the way through to when we left school. You know, age 18, she was still protecting us, and she didn't divorce my dad until literally we'd finished our A-levels, age 18, even though for years before that, we could all see, as kids always do, and they're far more astute than perhaps parents often think in terms of picking up on what's going on. And she was doing it all for the right reasons, but it did prolong the heartache probably, or the issues for her and for the rest of us. You know, police were involved a couple of times, you know, court orders to keep injunctions away from the house and stuff, because it just wasn't a healthy place.
Yeah. Why did he stop paying for your school fees?
So that was my next school. So I was very lucky when I left my first choir school that I was given it's called a music exhibition, so it's not quite a scholarship, to my next school, which didn't give much off the fees, but it meant that I was given a place at a good school. Wasn't particularly academic, but sort of worked my way through. And then in the last 2 years, he just stopped paying the fees. And I think, honestly, it was just to make a point that he was in control.
Yeah.
Incredibly, and thank God, you know, that because I was fairly active in the school in music and art and sports and other things, that I was considered to be a net contributor, I suppose, in a purer sense. And the leadership of the school, rather than, which they had every right to do, kicking me out and saying, sorry, the fees are not paid, you must leave, they took a really mature and kind empathetic approach and said, we think we can see what's happening here. And while you're contributing, you know, you're absolutely welcome to stay.
Mm.
And so I'm very fortunate that I then was able to stay in that environment where I had my friend network, which had been the thing that really got me through all of those earlier, you know, challenges of childhood or family life, got me through to the end. And my friends are the things that, you know, the people who continue to support and sort of give me that strength when things get difficult. But the negative, but the impact of sort of being told that, you know, while you're contributing, you can absolutely stay, whether it was, I don't remember it being necessarily a conscious thought at the time, but that was probably the start of the rest of my life in terms of how I lead my life, which is, you know, people always make fun of me for never just picking one thing to do. I'm always spinning multiple plates. And I think there was this subliminal pressure or worry that if somebody somewhere thought that perhaps I wasn't contributing enough or doing enough things to be seen to be contributing in net contributor to the school life, that I might just one day be told, can you come and, you know, see the headmaster and then get told almost like, you know, you're fired.
Mm.
So that's certainly been a flavor of how I've personally thought about or lead my life is I'm always, well, firstly, I love experiences. So good or bad, experiences is what makes life interesting. So I'll always throw myself into anything and everything, no matter what it is. But I think if you were to sort of unpick it and analyze it, there is definitely a subliminal never being quite good enough, never quite achieving enough and doing enough to do the right thing.
And so just kind of go over then the schooling. So you was in teams, you was in, what was you doing? Like extracurricular stuff with music? You know, I went to it.
Yeah. So,
you know, sorry, go on. No.
No, you
well, no, I was going to say that. Because I just went to a school where I'd go home, so there was, it wasn't the same, I don't feel yeah. like it was going to be the same pressure as, I can't really relate to it.
Yeah. So, you know, we were very lucky, we had incredible facilities, and I just saw all these facilities opening up in front of me, so I just wanted to try everything. So I, obviously, because I'd been given this sort of music scholarship, I had to continue to do music. I stopped singing, though, because it wasn't cool to be a singer. Then, or certainly in my mind, it wasn't cool to be a singer. So I remember
you got that wrong.
You know, if there's any music fans or music specialists, thing, they'll roll their eyes at this. But I thought, well, if I can still sing them, then they're going to make me sing. So maybe there's something I can do that will make my voice break quicker. So I used to walk around and sort of go and just try give myself a sore throat, assuming that that might cause my voice to break. And then, of course, I wouldn't be of any interest to the choir, to be honest. But I played a number of instruments, three different instruments, none of which were particularly manly in the grade scheme. I played the flute, the piccolo and piano. My friends still make fun of me that I was a flautist or played the piccolo. But I was in the, you know, I did rugby, very, very keen on rugby, and did that to a fairly decent level, and also rowing. But I've always been the smallest in every team I've ever been in. Annoyingly, I've always been the smallest person. So I've always felt like I've had to work harder or fight harder.
Yeah.
But to the point about not feeling like I might be doing enough, because I'd made it into our school, you know, the rugby first 15, whatever. But I'd also just got into the rowing team or the squad at least. I was terrified of being dropped from either. So I'd finish a rugby match and then run from the match, say, you know, see your fellas and run to the gym to do the rowing training, because if I wasn't seen to be doing that, so I'd do it in my rugby clothes just to, otherwise I'd feel like I might miss out. But it was a good time. And then, you know, carried on doing art and, you know, photography and other things.
Did you feel like your dad had control over you?
Not then. No, once he was no longer controlling whether I stayed or stayed or went, then a lot of pressure left me.
Yeah.
You know, I felt a weight lift from my shoulders and I used my limited talents in art to enable me to not have to go home.
Mm.
And it's probably sad to say, you know, most people would want to be with their families, and I desperately missed my, you know, time with my mum and my sisters, but I was worried that my return each time, which has been the sort of the history of it, that every time I came home, there would be an incident or episode linked to my return. It would always be the trigger seemingly for something happening, and I didn't want to put them through that. So I would always try and find ways to not go home. And I found that if I, you know, painted some pictures or did some drawings, then I could sell them for enough money to buy a plane ticket or a train ticket to go and stay with friends overseas or somewhere else in the country and have a more entertaining or pleasant holiday.
Mm. I'm not dwelling on your dad for you know, for any reason, but I feel that having a father is so important to a child. Did you like your dad?
Interesting question. I think I know I used to get frustrated hearing from drinking friends of his, you know, he weighs the life and soul of the party. He's so entertaining. You know, he's very eloquent. He's a very well read, you know, as a copywriter, he's very good with words and was always the raconteur in the pub. And so, you know, if you ever tried to tell people, actually, there's a darker side that impacts people in a really unpleasant way. No, quite often people didn't believe you. And that, I think that I found that frustrating. I mean, he was never, I say never, rarely physically abusive. I do remember when I was quite young, he was threatening to break my mum's arm, and I couldn't do anything about it because I was too little. And again, at the time, obviously, you don't necessarily think about it too, you know, the kids think in compartments. But when I was then at my other school and options came up to learn martial arts, I remember consciously choosing to learn judo and karate that I could perhaps better protect my mum and sisters when I was home if anything were to happen. But generally, it was more emotional abuse, which can be more debilitating, actually. At least bruises heal, but other things can sort of linger, I guess.
But did you ever like him? Did you ever want to please him? Did you ever want to?
If I did, I think, you know, and again, hindsight is a wonderful thing, and maybe I'm just rewriting history in my own mind, but if I forced to think about it, if I was trying to please him, it was almost to make sure that there were no other incidents or there was no what to not doing what was expected.
To calm a situation, to mediate a situation so it didn't make it any worse.
Yeah.
Instead of putting an arm around you and saying how proud, you know, that kind of thing.
You know, if that did ever happen, it was more the reflected glory rather than, in my mind at least, you know, actually being genuinely happy that you might have achieved something. It was so that he could tell everyone else that you'd done it, so it would look good.
Was you proud of yourself and your achievements going through school? Did you get a
feel of pride? I didn't think of it like that, to be honest. I just was so focused on trying to do as many things and do them with the best of my ability and be part of teams that were winning. You know, it was always great to be part of teams that were committed and winning, and that kept you almost busy enough or too busy to have to stop and really analyze, you know, anything else.
When you left school, so you left school 91.
Yeah.
What was the next step then? Was it to go back home? Was it to travel? What did you do?
I decided to take a gap year to try and travel, and I've been really lucky. And I can't remember exactly how the invitation came, but I was invited to join a rugby club called Harlequins in London, having done some representative level rugby at school. And so my first part of my gap year was spent just living at home. My parents having separated by this point, so I could stay in my mum's house, and that was obviously...
Where was that?
Down in Hampshire, near Winchester. And so I was playing rugby for the first part of the year, and I got a job as a school teacher, teaching primary school kids, 8-year-old kids, which was just amazing. Love kids. So much fun. And then through the links at the rugby club, there were a lot of internationals at the time, you know, and I was never going to be a full-blown international because I'm too little and not good enough, obviously. But I had a few breaks, and I remember the first time I turned up for training at Harlequins, all the hookers, and I was a hooker, believe it or not. I mean, I know my good looks, you probably think otherwise, but I turned up and all the other hookers were ill. So the England coach at the time, who was also the Harlequins coach, summoned the next available hooker. So I got to sort of play with all the big boys, you know, the Jason Leonards of the world, Mickey Skinner and Peter Winterbottom and all those names that you'll remember, you know, from the 90s. And there was an Australian international who had a buddy who was looking for some international players to come and sort of, you know, join their team in Queensland. So I got an offer to fly out to Australia for the Australian rugby season at the end of my gap year, and did that, which was incredible. You know, quite a learning curve. It's quite hard rugby out there. And then I went to university.
To do what?
Study geography.
Did you still play then?
I'd started playing because I'd done the representative stuff, but at the time, and it may have changed now, but my memory is that, you know, different divisions, England split into four divisions for rugby, or used to be. And so I played for South and Southwest England at school, and then at university, I was part of London and the Southeast, and that was run by Wasps. and Wasps and Harlequins didn't really get on, and we always, all the Harlequins people basically were told, "No, you're not going to get in." So right. I thought, I can't be bothered with this. So I stopped really playing rugby competitively and did rowing instead.
And what was the mindset like? So you'd gone from school where it was almost, kind of, you had to prove that you needed, you prove your worth, and you was worth, you know, keeping. Now at uni, was it the same kind of mindset? Was you always active? Was you always involved? Or was it more relaxed?
No, it's the same sort of pace, but in different ways. I mean, I don't ever consider myself to be particularly academic. But I loved the independence of university. And I think all those experiences up to that point had taught me a certain amount of resilience and independence that, you know, I would not have got had I done things differently. I mean, you know, we've talked separately about some of those other things that happened during school when I was just doing my own thing. But at university, it just was a continuation of that independent streak and being able to just try new things. But again, I was always seemingly, in my mind at least, fighting, because I was always the smallest and not quite, you know, I was always on the cusp of not getting into every team or being part of teams, but I just loved being part of, you know, teams or being involved in that teamwork. And that sort of, you know, all my closest friends are, you know, people generally that I've been in close-knit teams with, whether it's in the military or, you know, in sports.
Why did you decide to join the military?
When I was at school, we had a cadet force, and I quite enjoyed that. And that was run by a few ex-regular soldiers and some actually regular officers. And they suggested that I demonstrated some of the attributes that might be worth considering at least some time in the army. So I applied to join the army and joined after my university time.
Mm. Where did you join?
I joined the Gurkhas.
Yeah. How does that work? If you're not a Gurkha.
well, all the soldiers are Nepalese, but a third of the officers or so are British. So, I mean, I didn't honestly know much about the Gurkhas when I went to Sandhurst, you know, which is where you have to go if you're going to be an officer. You spend a year training at Royal Military Academy Sandhurst. And I'd actually gone, I'd been originally sponsored by the Parachute Regiment because that's who the soldiers were from in my cadet force. And then I, at university, was invited to go on an exercise with the Irish Guards, and then they said they wanted to sponsor me to Sandhurst, so I was sponsored by the Irish Guards, and then turned up and suddenly found the army had more than two regiments. It wasn't just the Paras and the Irish Guards. So I looked around and thought, well, if I'm only going to do 3 years, which is what I'd intended at the time, I thought I'd do 3 years and then get a proper job, whatever that is, that I would want as many interesting experiences as I could find. And the Gurkhas were based in Hong Kong, Brunei. They were jungle warfare specialists. They were in the airborne brigade, so I could learn to do parachuting with P Company. You know, you could get to do various operational tours, learn a language, learn a culture.
Mm.
And so, you know, I speak Nepalese not very well anymore, sadly, but, you know, I'm going for a curry on Friday night, so it'll help there, hopefully. You know, a great, great experience. So my first 3 years were spent, you know, really on a steep learning curve, learning all sorts of new things.
Is it different culturally then? Because being a troop commander or whatever for a bunch of British lads.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be different. I mean, the working language is English because it's the British Army. But, you know, like in any culture, if you go overseas as a contingent, you're going to still banter and chat in your local language. So it was really important as you know, a leader at whatever level, if you are not Nepali, that you speak or you make an effort to speak as good Nepali as you can. I think the biggest difference from my friends who were commanding or in teams with British soldiers was I spent less time in court. And we had, in my whole 3 or 4 years with the Gurkhas in that first phase, I think we had one guy who went to court once for drink driving. That was it. I mean, the cell that, you know, you'll be familiar, not necessarily from the inside, but you might be familiar with the guard room, you know, on the front gate where, you know, drunk blokes or whatever might get thrown in overnight to sober up. Ours was just full of furniture because it was never needed. but they were brilliant. I mean, I love them to death, and they've been so so good to me. You know, because whatever you do within the army, unless you transfer fully, you will always be, you know, part of that parent regiment. So
again, it's just one of your saying, and I've been on a few courses with Gecko engineer lads, and they're always the ones that are studying. Like, they will study until midnight and get back up the next morning, while the British lads are not doing that. Did you ever feel like they were a bit like you growing up as well? Again, I'm just making it up, but, you know, just this kind of like need to be proving that you're there and you're
aware. I don't know for them whether it's either of us, whether it's necessarily proving, but it's identifying that when you get given opportunities, don't waste them. Mm. I mean, at school, I remember there were a lot of, pretty well-off kids, and I'm, not trying to stereotype, but there were a lot of kids who didn't necessarily even need to work when they left. They came from, wealthy families or businesses, and some of them just didn't take advantage of the facilities. And that just, it used to frustrate me because these things come around so rarely to have amazing opportunities. So I think, for the Gurkhas, coming from a country like Nepal, when you are given the opportunity to improve your education or your skills, they just throw themselves at it. I remember one soldier I had who I ended up serving with in other places as well. We went to Belize on a jungle trip and a jungle warfare training trip. And in our R&R, rest and recuperation phase in the middle, we had a few days on one of the islands there to learn. And some of the guys wanted to learn to scuba dive. And he basically taught himself in English from the Paddy course book how to dive, having never dived himself. He came from the mountains. But he learned it all in, out of the English Paddy book. And then after the lessons that the blokes were having all day in English, he would then reteach them in Nepali, having translated it all, just to make sure that they were ready for the next day. So, they're pretty conscientious and their results are always immaculate.
Was it good going away then? Because 97 was Bosnia.
Did a short Bosnia tour in 97. That was my first operational experience. And while the main fighting had finished, the scars of that fighting were still very evident around, Gornji Vukov and places like that in Bosnia. And the stories that we were hearing from locals about the massacres that had happened in the areas that we were, just living in buildings, and people were still getting blown up. It was during the election phase, and the one side were mining the houses of the sort of other, or the residents from the other, not factions, but ethnicities that would be voting for opposition, and members of parliament, as it were. And sure enough, the first few people who returned from exile or refugees from Germany would come home, walk down their garden paths, and some of them were getting blown up. And then the rest would just not come because you had to be resident in your house for a period before the election to be eligible to vote. So that was quite shocking to see and hear how war can change people, really negatively. You obviously see it on the news, but just being close to it was shocking for me the first time. It didn't impact me, adversely, but it was just, I stopped and really caught myself thinking, God, this is pretty unpleasant what people will do to each other who had been neighbors in some cases, but the moment the war, the fighting started.
But also that desensitizing, actually laying a mine,
yeah,
to kill someone who's going to vote,
yeah,
a democratic process.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what everyone wanted.
Yeah.
That's,
but they only wanted their own people to win.
Go.
But that was interesting, and I really enjoyed that tour. It was an interesting time. We were, trying to help.
Mm. But the lads together, was you gelled then?
Yeah, yeah.
As a group?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So Northern Ireland, 98.
Yeah, short tour in Northern Ireland. That was brilliant. Really nice, really great bunch of guys working with some, home service, Royal Irish guys. That was interesting. Much more, almost more complex. Canada insurgency is obviously a more complex beast, but that was a really good learning experience.
Why did you decide to join the Army Air Corps?
Again, going back to sort of always wanting to challenge myself, I suppose, and try new things. I thought, well, I'd done my platoon command time, and the next few jobs were going to be desk jobs in the battalion, and I thought, well, maybe there's something else that might be of interest that I could try my hand at. So, my girlfriend at the time, she had just passed her selection to be a pilot or go on the pilot's course, and I had a few other friends who'd done the same. I thought, yeah, that sounds fun. So I did that, applied for that, and then spent 3 years flying.
How does it work then? So you go...
So you do about a year, you do a grading course, which is a short, I think it's only maybe even a week, or maybe it's not even that long, but I remember doing my grading where you're basically up with an instructor in a fixed wing plane, just learning to do basic stuff, and they're just determining whether you have potentially the aptitude to be a pilot. And I got on quite well, and my instructor thought that he would sort of push the envelope a bit and do a few more things than was actually in the lesson. There was one occasion where he said, I think you're ready to try loop the loop. Really? Okay. if you think so. So he goes, yeah, you know, I want you to go in this speed and then pull back the stick and da da da. And I was like, okay, fine. So I started doing that and then got up to the top of the loop and then completely cocked it up and stalled basically upside down, inverted stall. And then in my mind, and again, you know, hindsight as it is, it was like a movie, you know, the bad bits of Top Gun, I suppose, where the altimeter is just, you know, whizzing down and down and down. The G meter is going up. And I started feeling really lightheaded because it was spinning one way and he left it. I mean, he knew how to get out of it, but he thought, I wonder if he just naturally knows how to do this. So I pulled the stick the other way, thinking that would, you know, in the opposite direction. It just seemed to increase the speed and the ferocity of the spin. And as I was about to black out, this really calm voice in my ear said, I have control now. And then we flipped back up and then we carried on. It's like, oh, God, that was terrifying.
Yeah.
But anyway, they let me through. More fool them. And then learned to fly fixed wing and then helicopters and then did a lot of that. Again.
Links.
I was a Lynx driver, yeah.
And what was the main kind of job at that time?
We were doing counter-terrorist stuff, so mainly Northern Ireland-based work.
So this is 99?
Flying training took a year and a half. It's quite long.
Yeah.
We were supposed to be the first course that was going to get streamed onto Apaches, but that got delayed, so it was Lynx or Gazelle. And yeah, that was 2000 to 2002, actually operational flying.
Fine. Yeah. What did you gain from the flying stuff? Because it seems like people would join and be a pilot.
A whole bunch of guilt, honestly. I felt so guilty in Northern Ireland, particularly where, you know, often, and I don't want to stereotype, but where the weather's not always brilliant, and dropping troops off in the, you know, middle of the night in the pouring rain. And when if you've got your lights on or you can see them in your, you know, the troops on their little faces and the night vision goggles as you're looking out, and you could see immediately they are drenched to the skin, soaked to the skin, and they may be out for another week or something like that. And then these little eyes looking up at you in the cockpit and you're having to open the window because the heater's on a bit much. And I just thought, oh, I feel so guilty about this. So that's when I decided that, you know, I would rather be on the ground. I mean, I don't regret having flown at all. And it was a brilliant experience. And, you know, you learn, and again, another interesting skill. But I missed being on the ground with a team that's, you know, getting dirty, I suppose. Mm.
You then spent post-Lynx, you spent time in specialist military units.
Yeah.
You deployed to Iraq. Is that in 2003?
Yeah. So I did my first Iraq tour in summer 2003. So after the invasion, and yeah, that was an interesting time. You know, we'd done a number of operations. We were working primarily as a sort of joint coalition unit with the Americans and doing various types of missions, really. But on one of them on Halloween. In 2003, we ended up getting ambushed by an Al-Qaeda cell, I suppose, on a mission. And I was shot a couple of times, hit in both legs with some bullets, or luckily ricochets only, and hit with a couple of grenades, rocket propelled grenades. And a guy standing next to me was killed. Sadly, he was shot in the head and died instantly. And then a few others in the team were also hit. And that was quite shocking, as you would expect. It was the first really, really sort of up close and personal. I mean, I've been shot at before, but not shot before. And when people asked me to describe what it looked like or what the scene was, because we think we were hit by between 10 and 15 or maybe even 20 people firing from the roof of a building. We'd just gone into a compound. And so the range was about 20 or 30 feet, probably only. So the fact that four of us kind of staggered away is pretty lucky. And we're lucky that only more people weren't hurt more seriously or killed. But I liken it to a swarm of bees because a lot of the bullets were tracer rounds. So they had that phosphorus burning, you know, back to them. And it was like an orange stinging swarm of bees. And I spoke to a colleague from that time fairly recently. And given this was 2003, we'd not actually spoken about it. And he said, I've been meaning to talk to you about that, you know, that event. I said, oh, yeah, what about it? Because, you know, I was next door. On the next door compound. I said, no, I obviously didn't know that. He goes, when I heard it all kick off, I thought, what the hell is going on next door? He said, he put his head above just over the wall to have a look. And he's like, Jesus, you know, he said it was like in his mind, a washing machine of just bullets bouncing off everything. And the fact that anybody came out, you know, he was absolutely shocked. So that was quite a, you know, shocking thing. Not only, you know, obviously as a junior commander to have, in my mind, at least, failed by not bringing everybody home. That was, you know, quite hard to reconcile at the time. But, you know, you get through it. And, you know, we were stronger as a team having come through it.
Did you get medevac back?
Yeah, so it was quite a, ended up being quite a busy night with the sort of follow-up of what we were trying to, you know, to try and stop any other activity going on that compound. It, because it was a multinational thing, I had all the radios as the, you know, young commander, and there were jets above offering to drop bombs and helicopters offering to fire rockets into the building that we'd sort of extracted from. But one of the team had fallen into the compound. So, you know, I was trying to shout down the radio, do not drop bombs. We didn't want any more casualties. So it took a while for me to sort of leave, I suppose, the battlefield because I was worried that we might inadvertently have a friendly fire incident. But yeah, I was casevac to a military hospital and one bullet was taken out there and then flown back to UK. And another bullet was taken out.
Mm. And then the recovery process for you, was that straightforward?
It sort of, yeah. I mean, I was extremely lucky. And with everything, you know, and I caveat everything I'm saying, I'm sure there's people who've had far worse experiences. So, you know, this is not, I mean, I know you're interviewing me, but it's not about me. You know, there's many people I know who are suffering and have suffered far, far worse situations. So I'm very conscious of that. But I was extremely lucky. You know, firstly, the both bullets were ricochets. The negatives of those, I suppose, were I managed to contract E. coli and something else in Latin, I can't remember, or spell, because they bounced off, you know, dirty ground. But both missed everything vital. I mean, the one in my left knee was about a centimetre above my knee, so I was pretty lucky. If it had been a centimetre lower, I'd have almost certainly lost my leg. Mm. And my right thigh missed my femur and my femoral artery by millimetres. perhaps amusingly, another bullet did graze my bum on the way past, and that hurt more than anything else because it was one of the, you know, tracer rounds, and that, you know, if you get a burn, burns sting like hell. And so I thought that was the most sort of damaging hit, as it were. So although I was leaking, you know, blood everywhere from my legs, I kept asking people, can you check my ass? Check my ass. And so of course the blokes, you know, as they are kind, told everybody that I was shot in the bum running away. thanks for that. I've forgotten what your question was now.
Is recovery straightforward?
Recovery, yeah. So no, yeah. So because they weren't structural, they missed all the bone. That meant it was a fairly simple recovery, I suppose. Like back in the UK, one of the doctors I remember saying, "Look, it's going to be 6 weeks before you're allowed back." And I remember saying to him at the time, "Four for cash," and he looked at me and said, "What is wrong with you people?" Yeah. But I had this, again, perhaps it's, you know, genuine fear of missing out. You know, there was lots of interesting work happening and I was so young, or as a, you know, young commander and inexperienced, that every mission you were able to do as a part of the coalition or part of the army was a hugely valuable experience, and you never knew quite how many you'd get to do.
Mm.
And so I was desperate to get back so I could, you know, be back part of the team.
How long had you been in that unit for? Before you deployed?
About 4 months.
All right, okay.
So I was very new. On.
Yeah. Did you get back out?
Yeah, I got back in 4 weeks. I had to pretend in my fitness that it wasn't hurting like hell, but got back, and then I had to promise that I was going to carry on getting physio when I was there, but that I got that from the Americans, so that was good.
Mm. And then, I mean, you went for a really busy period.
Yeah.
I can't go into everything in too much detail. The one thing that I'm interested in, but because of, I suppose, the Afghan piece that was coming up, like the drugs trade was kind of roaring from that area. Did you have anything to do with that?
Well, the UK was the lead, I don't know if it's diplomatically, but certainly the Foreign Office and the government had a real focus in the mid-2000s in Afghanistan about trying to stop the drugs trade impacting, as it did, you know, the UK. Now, if I remember rightly, the statistic from the time was that 98% of the heroin sort of harvested, as it were, and or not heroin, opium rather, was making it onto the streets of Europe and the West. So anything that we as a nation or the lead nation of many could do to sort of stop that was helpful. So I was involved in a few things, helping, you know, the British government's effort in the counter-narcotics. You know, the UK raised the number of forces, you know, local indigenous forces that were going to be far better able to try and curb the trade and the growing of drugs. So that was an interesting time, my first experience of Afghanistan.
Mm.
And where I've met, you know, that first period, that's where I've met so many of my lifelong friends. I mean, I've, unfortunately, places like Afghanistan, Iraq, and others, you know, where you hear only the negative things and the, you know, the horrible incidents where people get hurt, but that's not the population. You know, the population of these countries are resilient and loving and kind and empathetic and, you know, amazing cultures. And I've got some brilliant friends from those times by spending time getting to know people and understanding them.
Mm. I mean, we've gone over helicopters, flying them. Can you talk in any depth about helicopter incidents?
there was one when I was flying where I broke a little bit off one once.
No, I'm on about when you're in the back of one.
Yeah, I mean, there's always, I mean, everybody who's been in the military, I'm sure, has had some sort of close shave or incident. And I've had a few. There were a couple, one in Iraq that's memorable and one in Afghanistan, I suppose. The Afghan one, we ended up, I think it was technically classified as a hard landing because nobody was killed, but the wheels fell off or got ripped off and the blades disintegrated and the thing nearly caught fire. That was a bit of a shock, I suppose. But as an air-aware passenger, I suppose, I wouldn't consider myself a pilot by then, but as a air-aware passenger, seeing what was about to unfold was awful. It's like, this is going to hurt. This is going to hurt. And all the Afghans there with me had all unbuckled their seatbelts already. There was about 30 or 40 in the back of this helicopter. And because there was dust, we were the fourth helicopter to land in a formation in the mountains in Afghanistan. And the pilot, I could see what he was going to do. The dust cloud was approaching us really rapidly, and he was trying to keep ahead of the cloud. But to do that, he had to keep the speed on. And I think we hit the ground at about 60 knots, which is not what you want to do. And the wheels, as I said, got ripped off, and then we fell off. We skidded on the belly of the helicopter into a riverbed and then smashed into the bank on the other side, and that's when it all started disintegrating and whatever. And I assume the pilots were dead because the engines were still screaming as if they had, you know, Chinook-sized blades, that they didn't anymore. Terrified the engine would explode. So I got into the cockpit because I was sitting at the front anyway, so it made sense. And I planned, in my mind at least, very quickly to go in and just shut it down and, you know, start the fire extinguishers in case anything was going to happen, assuming there would be dead pilots. And they were just looking at each other just in shock, kind of going, no, that wasn't supposed to happen. Yeah. So, you know, had to sort of shake them out of it. They were slapped one and punched the other one on the helmet and then they obviously did the shutdown and then it was fine. But we're very lucky. You know, the number of close shaves where when things go wrong, they tend to go very wrong with helicopters, and you just have to be really careful. I mean, they're amazing bits of machinery and you know, we've been reliant on them. And they are very, very safe. But when you're pushing them to the edge, you know, working in environments that are hot or high or, you know, difficult, you know, it can be challenging.
What's your relationship with trauma, especially on operations? Have you... Do you reflect back on incidents?
Yes, but not in a dark way. I mean, I think I've always been quite in the moment or able to compartmentalize, but again, not necessarily a compartmentalization that's conscious to try and protect or package trauma in different boxes so it's never going to be seen. I mean, I can think back to, you know, all the incidents that I've ever been involved in, and I know the ones that, you know, made me stop and think or that were particularly upsetting, you know, whether there've been kids involved or whatever. But I've just always been very lucky, I think. You know, my military time and my defense time, knowing that what, you know, my personal actions as a leader or otherwise, or the actions of my teams that I've been part of, have always been absolutely in accordance with the laws and the rules, and, you know, we've done everything for the right reasons to try and, you know, save lives and you know, keep people safe. And so I've never, ever had a problem sleeping. I don't get flashbacks from that time. But I do occasionally, you know, think back to incidents. And I know far too many widows and orphans of friends and colleagues, you know, over the years. You know, I stopped counting, honestly, you know, both American and British, particularly, and Afghan friends. You know, there must be more than 60 or 70 over the years who've been killed, and many more sadly wounded. And that, obviously, you know, it's sad when you think about those people who've paid the ultimate price for doing the right thing. But personally, I've been quite lucky. But as a leader at whatever level, you know, you are, I think, more aware of the risks of trauma and looking for the signs in others. And, you know, I'm absolutely aware that even though I'm you know, largely, in my mind at least, unaffected by my military service. You know, that's not to say that in 10 years, 15 years, something might impact me or affect me. And I also recognize trauma as cumulative. So with other things that have been traumatic in my life, you know, those things may just go on top of these other things that haven't actually bothered me at the time. You know, because you do get to see unpleasant things, you know, the other helicopter crash that you probably alluding to, you know, trying to drag dead bodies of people that are burning because their helicopter's on fire is not a normal thing to see or have to do. And to have to leave them because you've burnt your hands and you can't actually drag them out as the bullets of, you know, all the ammunition in that helicopter is exploding around you. No, having to make the decision and recognize that even though you want to avoid any further unpleasantness and, you know, give respect the you know, the bodies of those that have died and try and, you know, get them out as intact as possible so that the families wouldn't have to see something really hideous when they bury them. But having to give up doing that because you're likely to get killed just trying to drag them out because of all these other exploding pieces of ordnance. That's sort of, you know, sad, frustrating and sad at the time where you just, you know, you want to do the right thing, but you just physically can't.
There was one time, well, there was many times, but when you wanted to do the right thing and you couldn't, and that was when a vast majority of guys had been killed.
Yeah.
There were so many coffins and there weren't enough people to carry the coffins.
Yeah, so I found myself in Afghanistan doing a liaison job, actually just working in an ops room in a base with predominantly Americans. And it was when they had a really tragic incident where a helicopter crashed. And I think 19, if I remember rightly, 19 US service personnel were killed in that incident. And the headquarters wasn't very big. The ops room didn't have that many people in it. And they literally ran out of people to carry the coffins. And they just sent an email around saying, please, is anybody from the, you know, coalition, doesn't have to be American, but anybody be willing to carry the coffins so we can make sure that we do a, you know, proper ramp ceremony, put these flag draped coffins on the plane so they can fly home and we can share with their families that we've done everything, you know, for them. That, I mean, that those sort of things make you sit up and, you know, stop and take a gulp when you look at the back of a military plane and 19 coffins all in one incident are all there together, and thinking of the kids and the brothers and sisters.
You're allowed to feel sad. It's an emotion, isn't it?
And I think you have to, and I do remember a couple of times actually, just not that I was thinking it was normal, but sort of consciously going, just remember that this isn't normal, because, you know, you hear all the time of the desensitization issue. And if you start not feeling, then that's probably more of a worry than, you know, feeling sad or feeling something. So, you know, you do have to, I certainly remember thinking like, just remind yourself when you've seen that, they don't just sort of go, okay, that's just another incident, and just put it behind you. Actually stop and go, right, that's not normal. Log that, because otherwise, you know, you don't want to inadvertently start not really either caring or worrying about it.
That was 2009.
Yeah.
2009, your daughter was born.
Yes.
So a very...
A good year.
A good year.
An amazing year.
Did it change being a dad? As in, did it change your life becoming a dad?
Yes and no. So it didn't change my... I suppose it did change my military life. It didn't change my military life in how I approached my work and operations. I didn't suddenly choose not to do things that might be considered dangerous. That's just not how it works, for me at least. What it did change was how focused I have had to be on making the most of every moment with her, because, you know, sadly she doesn't live with me. She lives a long way away. On the other side of the world. And so what did change was that all my leave and all my focus was always that any time I was able to try and get to see her, that would be spent, you know, trying to be a dad and be present and be, you know, sort of somebody she could be proud of and a role model, you know, as she got older.
But those early, can I suppose, that early part, Afghan's still kind of going on.
Yeah.
Did it ever affect, like, decision-making? Did it ever affect your ability or inability to take risk?
I don't think it did, no. I mean, there were... No, honestly, I'm not just saying that for the purposes of this. I think, honestly, it didn't change any of my decision-making in my roles at all. You know, we had jobs to do, we did them, and I'd have done them exactly the same way with or without kids.
Mm. Was she on your mind?
Yeah, but not in those moments, not when you're in the heat of a, you know, gun battle or something like that.
Yeah.
But the moments where, you know, if you've picked up, clearly if you've picked up civilian casualties that, you know, the Taliban or whoever might have blown up kids, when you see kids in and around, of course, you know, it's only natural and normal for a parent to think, I wonder what my daughter or son is doing right now. I hope they're okay. You know, and I wrote a lot of letters to her, you know, during that time, just in case.
Mm. And how did it work then? So you, because you was away a lot.
Yeah.
And then coming back and trying to be her dad and having certain barriers put in front of you. Did you manage that? Did you manage it well?
I mean, I managed it in the only way I knew I could, by sort of throwing myself into doing everything I possibly could to do the right thing by her, to be as available as I could possibly be and fight for every moment with her, regardless of what sort of impact that had. You know, because of the situation, which obviously I can't go into, I did have to deploy a lot more than perhaps I would normally, or most people would normally have deployed. I mean, I was away for nearly 7 years altogether on operations. And the big chunk of that was in the last, you know, period after she was born, because I couldn't really afford to sort of live and eat and exist in the real world, as it were, with everything that was going on, to be able to spend time with her. So I would deploy to be able to just be able to then, when I did have time off, fly down and see her.
Mm. Do you feel like you've always been a dad to her?
I mean, it's difficult, clearly. Anybody listening who is a parent who is routinely separated from their child or children, you know, it is tough. And you would love, most people would love to do more. And I've always wanted to be there more and be more involved. But I know, again, like my military time, I've always done everything I can possibly do to do the right thing by her and be there as her supporter and, you know, dad and everything else. And we have an amazing relationship as a result. So, you know, despite the risks involved, you know, deploying just to be able to afford to spend that time and everything else, it's been absolutely worth it. And hopefully she will not appreciate it in a way. I never want her to, like I did, to sort of feel guilty for having opportunities, but I want her to know that, you know, everything was done always to be as present for her as possible from now and in the future.
Do you know, we talk about opportunities at the start and do you ever resent your father's opportunities compared to what you've got now? Because you get given limited opportunities with your daughter, which you take.
I mean, it doesn't make me, no, I mean, I don't I don't think of it like that, really.
No.
I mean, I kind of get feedback more from friends who say how frustrating it is when they have partners, ex-partners, in their cases, who have every opportunity to spend time with kids post-separation of whatever kind or flavor it might have been, and who just choose not to. They said that frustrates them when they see how hard others have fought or continue to fight for every, you know, sadly, I can measure time with my daughter in, you know, minutes, hours and days rather than months or years in terms of time together. But so it's not something I get, you know, it's not going to help, you know, me getting angry or frustrated about that is not in its way in the past. And although a lot of that childhood stuff was negative, I feel I've taken a lot of positives from it by knowing or thinking differently about how one should parent or could parent and being very aware of the pressures one can put on a child, either deliberately or inadvertently by your actions. And therefore, I'm grateful in many ways, although it wasn't by design, you know, for the independence it gave me, the resilience that it built up in me. I mean, a lot of kids would just have built resilience from being away from home from age 8. You know, all these things are all, I think, sort of helpful factors, actually, in the way that I've just taken opportunities. And so opportunity is kind of how I live my life, you know, see an opportunity and, you know, try and grow. And, you know, I know you talk about this a lot, and I'm a fully signed up advocate of the post-traumatic growth, whatever that trauma is, whether it's major, minor, chronic, acute, just finding ways to see positivity in it can just be a hugely, hugely powerful and impactful thing to do.
Would you say you suffer more with your lack of access to your daughter? than you have
than my military work. Mm. It's definitely affected me more. I think, you know, I'm, although I, you know, as I said earlier, I don't get the flashbacks and the kind of things that one often hears, people suffering, you know, really serious PTSD and other kind of brain trauma or incidents, you know, can feel. But I'm definitely more emotional as a result of the trauma of that sort of fight, I suppose, to be a dad. And, you know, often when I'm on a plane or somewhere and I see even a really innocuous TV show or a film, and I think they're non-smoking these days, but I often find mine are very smoky. There's tears rolling down my down my cheeks quite often when I'm watching, you know, films that really shouldn't be causing me to get emotional. So I think, you know, what it's done is make me far more aware. My emotions are much closer to the surface. Yeah. I mean, I've always been, as I said, I've suffered from imposter syndrome and therefore aware of the vulnerabilities that one has. And I think there's a lot of strength in vulnerability. And so it's not something I hide or shy away from, just acknowledge that, you know, we're complex beings. And but yeah, to answer your question, long story long, I suppose, is that, yeah, the family, the parenting aspects of life have been more challenging or traumatic in terms of trying to do the right thing and finding that hard.
Is your daughter growing up well-rounded?
Yeah, she's incredible. She's a hoot. She's a really lovely young lady, huge bags of empathy, which is just so lovely to see. She's always the person who will go and involve the new kid who's on the side, having not been picked. She's always the one to go and check on everyone else. She's funny. I mean, she's still quite young, only 10 at the moment, but she started, maybe it's from my musical background, but she's got an ear for accents. So she does some ridiculous accents, which is hilarious. And, you know, to give you an example of what she sort of character she is, she's, I wouldn't say she's shy. She's not a shrinking violet. And she was with a friend last summer, and these friends came from America, and one of the daughters was about a year older than her. And they suddenly, between them, concocted this idea that let's busk. So they were in London. And they said, we want to busk and raise some money. Said, oh, yeah. What do you want to raise money for? Kids with cancer. Okay. what are you going to do? We're going to dance and sing. Okay, fair enough. So we were outside the Globe Theatre about to go and see Midsummer Night's Dream because you know, they all like Shakespeare and history and stuff. And so they started singing seasonally inappropriate songs in baking hot July, Feliz Navidad, and always sort of Christmas songs and doing these ridiculous dances. And kids on school trips were even giving their pocket money to these two lunatic children who were dancing around. One Chinese guy stopped and said, can you make a video? I want my daughters to be as confident as you. So they were saying, you know, you can be confident. And I mean, they were just really, really cool. But we were a bit mean shortly after that. She asked again when we went to have dinner on the South Bank, you know, is it okay to busk here? I said, well, you're supposed to have a license, I think, but you should be all right. And they go, okay. So off they went to busk, and we could see them from the restaurant we were at. And then a policeman literally walks past our table just patrolling the beat. And I said, excuse me, I know this is a bit mean, but can you go up and ask those girls if they've got a license? And these guys said, oh, you're a horrible man. I said, I'll just do it. It'd be quite funny. So off he went and said, excuse me, ladies, have you got a license? And then I took some pictures and their poor little faces. Oh. And my thoughts, we're raising money for kids with cancer. And then, and of course, we went, you know, they raised about £35 in about 30 minutes. And we went to Marie Curie and they, you know, she got a letter saying, thank you for raising money for cancer.
Amazing.
So she's that kind of kid. So I'm very grateful that, you know, she's growing up to know what is right. And I always tell her, you know, have courage and be kind, always be kind to people. So yeah, she's cool.
You left the military in 2016.
I did, yeah.
What's the future hold?
Well, a bit like you probably, as a service person, I know all the amazing work you're doing and, you know, even this podcast, but to raise awareness, I just feel like I'm hardwired to serve in some capacity. So, you know, service from being a child singer in the choir, serving others in the, you know, cathedral, etc., then serving in military in the uniform, and now I feel like I've got to give back because I'm very lucky to have come through all the things, you know, most of which we haven't even touched on, but to have come out fairly unscathed. You know, technically I'm physically disabled, but compared to, you know, many others who are really badly hurt and really suffering, you know, I don't consider myself disabled in the same way. But I just feel like I've got to give back and do what I can. So I'm throwing myself into a lot of mental health charity work to try and raise awareness, not only for military, but actually for first responders and all those who see trauma, who are serving others, who may be affected short or long term from the mental or physical impacts of that service. You know, I fully recognize that while we deploy a lot in uniform, military uniforms, you know, a paramedic scraping people off the motorway, you know, every day for a month, we'll see more trauma than most of us in 22 years or more of service. So, you know, I want to do what I can, not only for the military community who clearly are suffering in many ways, but actually for many others as well. And, you know, there's a campaign that we're going to be setting up that we'll announce in due course that's going to try and raise $1 billion globally to help all of that community. Not trying to set up a new charity, but just trying to shine a light on service and help all veterans of service. So, you know, veteran in many countries means military or is synonymous with military. But actually, I'd say service is the key word here. And I want to try and do what I can while I can, because I've got far too many friends who are suffering from their time, you know, doing things for others. And, you know, who knows who you know, you or I might need this help in the future. So, yeah, that's the future. And just try and, you know, do the right thing.
Ashra, how can we follow you on social media?
All my hashtags, or not, all my handles, I suppose, the same, Ash Alex Cooper.
Yeah.
So Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, all that stuff.
Yeah, and we'll be putting stuff out as well.
Yeah.
Mate, thank you so much.
No, thank you.
And we'll leave it there.